SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews, taking you inside the sport of kings. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're here with one of our favorite people in the entire industry, in the history of the industry, and always a rare privilege on At the Races when we get to visit with Tommy Trotter. And Tommy up at Saratoga in town for the annual Jockey Club Roundtable. He's attended virtually every one, and it's been an absolute Trotter Fest 2017, everywhere you've gone. Tommy, great to have you here in Saratoga.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here, Steve. And look forward to the Jockey Club meeting tomorrow. So, and having been there years ago when it first started out, 25 people, I believe, and now they're up to about 200 in attendance, yeah.
And, you know, we'll start right there, actually. And for those of you that have listened for years, you know that Tommy, just a legendary official in the sport, racing secretary and racing department for countless racing associations. We'll hit on those. But the roundtable is a fascinating topic. The Jockey Club has basically, over the years, turned it into sort of a state of the industry presentation. But you explained the other day to me, which was instantly fascinating, that it started out more as a marketing idea exchange.
You're correct. There would be, say, 25, maybe 30 from every racing state. Could be a racing secretary, could be a starter, a steward, or patrol judge, or whatever. And it was done very well with the with the backing of the Jockey Club, and it was very informative. We would sit there and discuss problems that would go on in racing, and see how they're doing in how they do it in California or wherever, or Jersey, and we would all of us exchange ideas. And I think I'll say for my part, we did get a lot out of it. It was really good to hear the various subjects that would come up. One of them would be, say, the running of an entry in a race, 1 and 1A, and that came up at one of the meetings. Now, this is how things have changed. And at that time, they said, you know, what about if we break up the entry so you do have another betting interest?
Two betting interests.
Right, and I can remember one of the stewards standing up and say, are you kidding? We'll have a riot, you know, if the wrong horse would win. The long shot wins and the 3 to 5 runs dead last. So
and that's something, you know, and I want to pause. We'll keep fleshing these out because it'll throw out all kinds of issues that the game has dealt with in the interim and subsequently.
Right.
And that's a perfect example. I mean, you're talking about a conversation from decades ago, and in the last 10 years or so,
right,
that topic has really, really evolved, where the demand for betting interests has outstripped the concern in terms of an entry and the kinds of issues that entries existed.
Right.
But at the same time, Tommy, I'll say this. There's plenty of occasions where the existence of the entries were really more problematic, particularly if one side of an entry scratched pre-race.
Right, right.
There's less problems.
Yeah, there's,
I think there's less problems the way we're doing it more these days.
And I, being a racing secretary, would love to see that happen then. You know, here we had a steward's view, and here's the racing secretary. And I think all of us sitting there saying, oh, it would be great for us when you're trying to put together a program and you get another interest, so to speak, to run, you know. And they still keep them together today, same ownership. But when it was different ownership,
right,
that it was the way to do it. And Of course, this official, I remember him, and he had many years behind him and all, and that the subject was over, you know, when he said what would happen, and nobody went against it. But I was so glad when I saw it being changed myself, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah, the Derby, it seems, had a lot to say about that, and you know, the reality that there was that there were going to be super trainers, quote unquote, the Lucas and Pletcher, Zito, and the fact that the Derby wanted 20 betting interests,
right,
as opposed to 20 horses and 15
betting interests
or less.
I mean, right.
There was the year Zito ran five, and there's been a year Pletcher ran five, and so the other than common ownership, it makes perfect sense.
Right.
And even now, they're running even with common ownership. They're letting the individuals run.
Right, you got it. And you made a good point too, saying, you know, an entry scratching late, and you've already
purse
bet
money,
on it, and
purse money only.
Yeah,
they make the entry run for purse money only, and there's plenty of people that maybe wanted the horse. This happened with Eddie Barker last summer, right here at Saratoga,
right,
where Eddie had an entry. Everybody was anticipating that the one that scratched was the horse to bet. That horse scratches. The other one runs for purse money and wins and would have been on a standalone. That horse would have been 30-1.
Yeah, wow.
And Eddie probably more annoyed than anybody.
Yeah.
This is a perfect example, Tommy, of how the topics in this sport have not appreciably changed in decades. Well,
yeah.
For the better,
yeah.
or in decades.
Right, right.
The same issues.
Yeah, it is. It's good to see. And this meeting, as I say, when we only had about 25 there, it individually, it helped everyone walk away from there and gain some knowledge out of it. And that went on for maybe two or three more years, and then it grew and to what it is today, maybe about 200, with different topics, more on veterinarian and public relations.
Issues at large.
Right.
What year? What was the first year that you recall?
I can't recall just what. It had to be somewhere about 1960, I think.
How about that? So you're talking 55-plus years.
Right, because that was the year I came in from Chicago as the racing secretary when Jimmy Kilroy went to California.
Well, and over the course of this conversation with Tommy, you will hear one legendary name after another, like that of Frank Jimmy Kilroy. Just your career, and even in retirement, your ongoing association with the sport and with so many people. And you know, one of the things, Tommy, that I hate that I have to do every so often over the last 10 plus years is reach out to you when a contemporary has left us. You know, Alan Jerkins last year, you contributed to Alan's the Chiefs tribute show and things like that. But you have seen literally three quarters of a century of the sport, and you grew up in it. You grew up from Louisville originally.
Correct. Right. My grandfather, great-grandfather, and my father were all trainers. And just to throw out a little story, I was asked the question about, do trainers run as much today as they did years ago, often and with a little time in between. And this trainer, who is now deceased, by the name of Lee Cotton, came to me and he says, Tommy, I want you to look at this chart book. And he said, your grandfather ran a horse in there. And he said he won the race. And this is out west somewhere. And he said he ran him right back the next day, and he won again. And I said I couldn't believe it. But I paged through the book, and that was true of those years, you know. And we do see towards my end of my career that trainers have slowed down a little bit, you know, on running the horses, that we have more racing and more problems and all. So, but anyhow, that was one of the things about the
What was the first? What's your earliest memory of about being at the racetrack? And were you at that time? Was the family fairly stable in
yeah,
Kentucky?
In Kentucky, my father, being a trainer, his stable was there. I have a photo at home of the dad's horse winning, and here's my mother and her two sisters with all of the children. I think there were 11 of us, and I'm on the end down there, and I think it looked like I was probably about 5 or 6 years old at the time.
Did you grow up close to Churchill?
We our home wasn't more than a mile to Churchill Downs, and it was on our way to school, so some days we'd be walking there.
Who do you remember? And you know, just by you know, you're 90, you're going to be 91.
Correct. Next month
in September, and that I mean that puts you squarely into you know into the 30s growing up. I'm trying to think of I mean was Matt Wynn still alive? When did Matt Wynn
yes,
die?
Yes, Matt Wynn was still alive.
Did you meet?
No, I never did. No, okay. I was too young then. But a little side story, my mother's father had a track kitchen at a racetrack called Douglas Park, which was about maybe 10 miles from Churchill Downs. And they raced there at one time. And she was brought up, she and her two sisters, and a brother who was a jockey. Now, this is going back probably in the early 20s. And her father said to her, Helen, I want you to take a horse, you and Jimmy, the brother, over to Cuba to run. And because there was no winter racing in Florida at the time, and very well, so the horse went on the train down to Key West, went on a boat over to Cuba, and they stayed there for the meeting, Oriental Park. A horse by the name of Belle of Elizabethtown, and my uncle rode the horse. The horse won, and back to Kentucky after that.
You know, you prompted the next really sad and amazing story in racing history that anybody that's read the Racetrack Mysteries book and knows the game's history. Your dad, nicknamed.
He had a nickname, Tobe, T-O-B-E,
yeah.
Right.
He and Al Snyder.
And a man by the name of Don Frazier from Canada. He didn't own horses, but he was with the Jockey Club in Canada and became friends with my father over the winters. And my father, along with Mr. Campbell in New York, the racing secretary, and one of Dad's owners, a couple of his owners, all pooled money and bought themselves a yacht, say about 65-footer or a little more. And anyhow, Dad loved fishing and spent a lot of time in New Orleans. And in addition to any time he wasn't running a horse, he'd probably be on one of his owner's boats. You know, we can't go out today. You're welcome to use it. So many times I was with him when down in the area where he was lost. And anyhow, the Flamingo was over, and Al Snyder was riding him at the time and had done a very good job. I don't think he ever got beat on him as a
citation.
And so my dad was going fishing, and he got a group of six together, and the other three were one of my dad's owners, and I believe a jockey agent, and I forget who the other one was. And they set out from Miami River on March the 5th, 1948. And they went all the way down to Maticumba and then on to Key West, and then went west into what they call Sandy Key. And they had a skiff that they pulled behind the boat, the large boat. And they anchored, and the next day they one group went fishing in the morning and the second group in the afternoon. And the three in the afternoon was Snatter and my dad and Mr. Fraser. And the other three were left on the big boat. And they went out. They had oars. They had anchors. They had pads that they could sit on, but were also life preservers. They had an anchor. And in that area where I had been with my father, you could jump overboard. It was only about 4 feet. And a storm came up, and but the man on the big boat said he could still see the skiff and see them casting. And then darkness came along, and they figured they put up on one of those islands. Well, morning came, and no signs of them. And they got on a radio and called the Coast Guard. They were there in no time. And it turned out to be the largest search, they say, in Florida. I think the Goodyear blimp was in on it, the Coast Guard, and many of the owners chartered planes. And I was working on Tropical Park at the time, and my brother was up at Notre Dame, called him, and he came down, and the two of us went on a chartered boat for 2 weeks. And I mean, they covered the whole area, and the boat showed up about 5 days later in a called Rabbit Key. I was there when the boat came in, and on the bow was a piece of rope that had been cut. And other than that, the whole boat was stripped. The outboard was not there, the oars and the anchor. And that was the end of it, the mystery. One morning, I got a call from Cuba. Tommy Trotter, this call's for you. And I got on the phone, and hello, hello, and a disconnect. Never heard who was calling me. That was one of the mysteries. But they never found any of their clothing and
nothing,
right?
It's one of the great and it turns up in sports mystery books, and because Al Snyder, the prominence of him and your dad, and it's one of those things that you read about, and I did not realize until we talked the other day about this I knew of the story,
right,
but didn't know besides Snyder that your father would have asked you about this long before. You must have been 13, 14.
I was a little older, 21.
Oh,
Dad was 46.
Wow.
And usually Eddie or Carol would have been with him. Eddie went with my dad before fishing. He's out at Santa Anita, and Al Snyder called him. Eddie, why don't you come on? Tobe Trotter's, we're going out. He said, you'll have a lot of fun. And he said, but I can't. I'm riding a horse in the stake here, so I can't get back there in time. As it turned out, with Albert gone, Eddie or Carol replaced Snyder as the Triple Crown winner. On Citation.
But at the same time, Al Snyder was already on Citation,
right,
because Arcaro had chosen Coal Town.
That's right.
To ride.
You are right. Correct.
He thought Coal Town
was
going to be
the
better of the two.
Nice horse, too. You know, a lot of speed. But Citation, to me, did things that I don't think any three-year-old has ever done. At Hialeah, the two owners, Warren Wright, that owned Calumet Farm, and the man, Moore, I believe it was his nice name, owned a three-year-old. They were buddies and golfers at the Indian Creek Country Club. And they used to kid each other about who's got the best three-year-old. Warren Wright said to Jimmy Jones, or Ben Jones, I want you to have this horse ready for the Flamingo. You know, I got this man to beat. And he says, so have him in good form. So Ben Jones decided, well, where am I going to run him? You know, here he is. Now a three-year-old with where allowance conditions would keep any other trainer from going in a race with him. So he decided, well, I'm going to run in stake races for three-year-old and upward. One at a short distance, 7 furlongs, and the other one at 1 mile and 1 furlong. And he said, I'm going to go with them. And in Citation, won both of them. And he didn't just beat ordinary horses. They were the top sprinters and the top horses going a distance of ground. So that impressed the jockey. He said, boy, what a horse this is going to be, you know. And he was. He was just, I think it was Jim Fitzsimmons that said, I saw Man of War run, and this horse is better than Man of War. That was his quote in a book on Citation.
Expand on this topic, and whether it's Triple Crown winners or some of the great geldings of the the particularly the post-war era or
right.
or just before, among those types of horses, Whirl Away, of course, and Armed and Assault and. We bring up Citation. If we get into the 50s, that class of 57, which is my favorite, and General Duke, and Bold Ruler, Gallant Man, Iron Liege, and Round Table. Talk about some of the horses, Tommy, from that era that, I mean, a lot of these you can bring up that people are intimately familiar with, but the ones that maybe don't get enough credit from your perspective, having seen them live, and certainly there's horses that are lost to history. General Duke probably
right.
more so than any.
Right. Well, of course, my favorite was Kelso, who was owned by Mrs. Allaire DuPont, and Carl Hanford trained the horse. Who worked, my dad gave him his first opportunity to ride, Carl Hanford, and he ended up training Kelso. And he carried weight that we just don't see today and won with it. And a five-time horse of the year. And he just was, to me, the best I've seen in my period. And there was a good horse, Four Go, and of course, we know Secretariat as a three-year-old and all what he did. So many, many good horses in those years and many good trainers, too. And
talk about the trainers. And you mentioned Carl Hanford, who's honored down at Delaware, and his daughter, Gail, still
right.
still associated. And that's one of the things that particularly for you this trip and also during the winters for you down in Florida, for you and Ellie, where you get to see people there's only a certain number that are contemporaries, but lots of sons and daughters and nieces and nephews and so forth and people that know that their parents worked for you or with you in racing offices. It's got to be a treat, to come and be honored, wherever you turn up.
Right. Oh, yeah, there was, to give you a story on my father, another good older horse, Stymie.
Oh, absolutely.
My dad was very friendly with Max Hirsch, King Ranch. And dad was looking for a horse to buy for one of his owners, and he went over to Max and he said, Max Hirsch, and asked him, he said, if you got anything for sale? He says, Toba got Stymie here for about $1,500, But he said, I'm running him today at Jamaica. And after the race, you can have him, So as you recall, the race is run. I don't know whether the horse won or not, but Hirsch Jacobs claimed the horse.
off Hirsch went.
And there went Stymie, but my father never regretted in a way. He just said, I had an opportunity to claim him myself later on, because Hirsch Jacobs ran him back for $1,500. So, it's stories like that really keep your interest in racing.
There's no doubt. I've got to ask. One of the real honors that we've had on the show over the 10 years was conversations with John Nayrud, and he obviously had occasions to work around and with John and see his best horses like Dr. Fager and Tawee.
Right.
The fact that you both stayed close to the game into your 90s says a lot as
well.
Well,
with John Nayrud, the last horse that Dr. Fager won, it was in the fall at a short distance, I believe. And he says, what are you going to put on this horse? And I said, well, I don't know, John. I haven't gone into that yet, what weight. And he says, you can put whatever you want.
He wanted one. Right.
Yeah, whatever you want to put on the horse.
This is Tawee.
Yeah, and then Tawee in the fall high weight handicap. The rule goes that the top weight cannot be less than 160 pounds. And he had Tawee win as a three-year-old filly. I believe she carried 140, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah.
And won as a three-year-old and then came back the following year and won with more weight as a four-year-old.
Yeah, there's a great topic, too, you know, the weight-carrying era. And we've seemingly moved beyond it to an extent. And yet at the same time, Tommy, we have not gone to the European weight for age.
Right.
What's your feeling about the value of retaining the scale of weight, and if we should cling to it, in, you know, because the handicap concept is less and less employed. I mean, we're seeing more and more conditional races,
right,
and less handicap.
Yeah, well, I think the scale of weights as good as it is now, that what it does for a handicapper gives you an idea of what to assign weight on a, say, a three-year-old racing against an older horse. The spread of weights there, where I just, when I said Citation won in the January and at Hialeah as a three-year-old against olders, you just don't see that. You won't see very few times in my career that I'd ever see a three-year-old going against an older horse in the early part of the year. But as the year goes, as with the months go by, they come closer in weights. So I think that a scale of weights is good. Of course, the handicap division, there was talks about maybe doing away with handicaps altogether. And I feel this way. If you come to the Jockey Club Gold Cup at Belmont or the Woodward or stakes like that that are weight for age, how many horses would you be able to get in the race? If you have a Kelso running or a Dr. Fager and they're carrying the same weight as your horse, you know, you're just not going to get too many horses in the race. And speaking of owners, Mrs. DuPont, I knew her well and a wonderful woman. And in all of my years assigning weight to Kelso, our friendship never ended. And she never once brought up weight at any time. And any time we'd show up at a party together or something. And, of course, the trainer, Carl Hanford, being almost like a family member, never once said anything. Tommy, don't you think you're going a little too high? But so it made him a good horse and forego the same way. Today we're seeing a little less, but I don't think we've come up with horses like that yet. You know,
there's less of them. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
And I think racing secretaries, I don't think they. Other than the fall high weight,
right?
There just isn't the inclination to weight a horse, you know, out of competition. Really,
yeah.
I mean, although you never had to tangle with Bobby Frankel, right? But Bobby, you had already
coming around and stayed in New York for a great number of years and headed to California. And did well out there too, you know.
But he was a fighter. He would go into a racing office and argue.
Yeah,
with
you would. I didn't have any with him, but he may have got some of the staff, you know.
No doubt. Speaking of which, and you mentioned California, and I mean, we could bring up. I mean, I literally could name. I mean, you worked at almost two dozen different racetracks over the years, and
22.
There you go.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is the vast majority of tracks that you were associated with. Yeah, they're still around. I mean, there's certainly some places, you know, like a Garden State that's gone and
Centennial's gone in
Colorado. Look at
right.
that.
Washington Park's no longer there.
Fire victim. Quite a few fire victims. a number of tracks that burnt down. Actually,
I was there at Arlington Park
for the big fire.
I was living there. What had happened was they were building a home for me nearby, and I spoke to them about they would have rooms for some of the officials that wanted to live on the grounds. And I said, well, like my wife and one son here with me. And so they gave us a bedroom up on the second floor. And about, say, around 3:30 in the morning, I woke up, smelled smoke. And I woke my wife up. I said, "You smell any smoke?" "No," and right back to sleep. My son's in the other bed. I woke him up. "No, don't worry, Dad. There's a grill up there on the ceiling. They have a kitchen downstairs, and it's probably coming from the kitchen." And I wasn't satisfied. I grabbed a flashlight, went down the stairs, and I didn't see a thing for a while. And then I looked up on the ceiling, and here's a layer of smoke. And right up the stairs I went, grabbed a phone on the wall, called the fire department. I said, "We got a problem over here," and gave him the location. And, "Well, okay, now you got to stay on the phone." I said, "I can. I got to get my family out." And then there was another man living there, the chauffeur. And so upstairs, and I told her, "Get the car and get away from the track." And there was a little wind and just a bit of rain. And it didn't, nothing happened to the barn area. We were out of there and watching it on the outside, and it didn't take long. At 10 o'clock that night, it was completely flattened, and they did still go ahead and run the Arlington
Million.
They
ran the Million, and of course,
they called it the Miracle Million, yeah.
The Miracle Million, and then the rebuilding of Arlington, and we are recording this on Million Day.
Right.
And you were on hand. Talk about Dick Duchossois and the origins of the Million, because it's one of the great stories, and it's become not just one of the great races in American on the American racing calendar,
right,
Tommy, but it also feels like it's been instrumental in the growth and the proliferation of turf racing in America. I think a lot of it can be tied over these last 35 years to the Arlington Million, and that it really helped the growth of grass racing in North America because
right,
it's almost at par now with dirt racing.
Right. Well, when we talk about turf racing, I give credit to Hasty House Farm, Allie Rubin had owned that, and Harry Trotsik was the trainer. And I believe on the East Coast, they were the first ones to start bringing up horses from South America. But going on to Dick Duchossois, I was working there at Arlington Park when the idea came up. Joe Joyce, who's now deceased, was the one that spoke about it, and we laid out plans to how we were going to do it. A position was to invite the horses that came and get a group of handicappers, racing secretary handicappers together to make the selections. And that's what we did. And with the first running, and it turned out to be a great race to begin with. And then when this fire occurred, it set up the place. He did it in 1 week. He had an outfit come in called Cleveland Construction, I believe, and they cleared everything out, and it looked like a country-type race track then. And they turned out with a big crowd and a good race, and then from then on he went, and he's got a beautiful track out there, just really beautiful. And the turf racing is growing. Any track that can afford it and can put it on, they're going to do it, you know, because it gives you another type of horse to work with. Many times horses are good on the turf only and they can't handle the main track.
The nice thing, too, is that turf in general is a little easier on horses. A
lot easier.
They don't run full out for.
They stay around longer, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, John Henry, the one that won out there.
The classic.
Yeah, was it. There was a horse that they couldn't sell, you know, when he
absolutely
was up for sale, and he was bought and turned out to be the trainer still in California, Ron McAnally.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, we look at the, in fact, today I've got the picture of, as opposed to the statue, the beautiful statue of John Henry and the BART.
Right.
The actual photograph, which is in black and white, and it's got the date, one of those individual date signs that hangs right at the wire, for the photograph equipment to capture. And it's really one of the great moments in racing history. When you were in New York, certainly, the luxury of the double wide turf course,
right.
The ability to ride turf sprints, which have really become popular, really grew out of the Mid-Atlantic.
Right.
The Mid-Atlantic region seemed to, I don't know whether it was Lenny Hale or who it was that really got that concept forwarded. Bobby Humphrey was a big proponent.
Right. That's true. They will do more damage to your turf course, more so than a mile and a half or whatever.
Yep.
But the BART, when you spoke of him, the trainer John Sullivan was in California, Santa Anita at the time, and when we spoke, I knew him from years, and he said, my horse, Tommy, is going to run a good race. This horse is really training well, and looked up his performance. Well, he could see it more than we could, and he just got beat.
You made me think of another topic, when bringing up names like Lenny Hale and Bobby Humphrey and, earlier with Jimmy Kilroe, talk about some of the people that came through your offices and worked under you that have gone on to great careers.
That would be one of them, Lenny Hale and Bob Humphrey, and those two. Can't think offhand just who the others were, but it just seemed like any track I did work as a racing secretary, we really had some competent and very good officials, and it made for a good office. They just treated everyone well and did their job. And New York was one of them. I mean, I've got a picture of about 25 of us on there, and they were just great officials.
There's been so many names that have come across and have come up just in the last couple of days, sitting with you and with Ellie, and when we've had these parties with Bill Hirsch and Mary Ryan down in Florida that are so much fun. The people that that you think of at any particular time, and it might be when you're watching a stake, you're watching the races, and Ellie says that you watch every day and keep tabs on everything, although you're not a bettor.
You
really don't bet.
No,
because you came from an era where the officials you couldn't place
couldn't
a
bet.
Wager.
No, that's true. And even I'm not I'm
You could,
retired now, and
but you could bet.
Still,
yeah,
I could, but I still don't.
That's right. Ellie's betting. I see her. She's betting plenty.
She is a good handicapper too.
Too funny.
Yeah.
In terms of some of the people on the track side. I mean, because you worked. You've got some pictures, and just glancing, and when you see Phil Islin and Amory Haskell, Marge Everett, who you worked for as well.
At Arlington, and then again at Hollywood Park. And I was completed Gulfstream and
the Dons, the Don family.
And I've worked for all three, the Don's family, the grandfather, the father, and then Doug Don. And she said, Tommy, can you come out? I'll make you director of racing, I believe was the position. I said, no problem, and let me check it out with Doug Don and wherever else I was working, and no problem. And it was a good meeting out there. And I really got along well with her when I worked at Arlington Park. And she wanted me to stay on in 1960. When Jimmy Kilroe called to say, Tommy, will you come here to New York? And I said, I'm still here locally. He said, well, I'm going on to California, and your name has come up. And I was going to be under Doc Lavin that was Churchill Downs, and I think he had about five racetracks. And he said, he's going to be the racing secretary. Would you be his assistant? I said, sure. I said, I worked with him at Tropical Park, and I know him, and I like him. He says, well, okay. And then a week later, he decided he wouldn't go. He wanted to keep his other five tracks. And so Mr. Haynes will be calling you to ask you to come to New York. And when Marge heard that, she got told of Jimmy, leave Tommy alone, you know. And so anyhow, he got on the phone and offered me the job, and I took that, and that was 1960. Yeah.
Did you work at Hialeah for John Brunetti?
I did. That came up when the races secretary, I was working Arlington at the time, and a fellow around there that knew John Brunetti well, he told me, he said, the racing secretary went to Dubai, and would you want to take the, I said, let me clear it with Doug again and wherever, and at Chicago. And anyhow, I got the job at Hialeah for the second time. I worked there when John Galbraith bought it.
Wow.
Yeah, and John Clark was there as the president. And Horatio Lyrell's wife was one of the stockholders. And it was a good meeting, too. Really nice. Beautiful track.
When you say that, you know, that comes from an era when you reference a meeting when the community of racing secretaries would kind of come in impromptu,
right?
And there would be, and you would bring your own staff a lot of times,
right.
And you guys would quickly assemble, you'd run a meet, and then you'd go on to something else, and,
right.
And it was very seasonal,
right.
And in fact, in Oscar Otis's autobiography,
right.
He talks about that from a, you know, and he was mostly on the West Coast. He had a fascinating career as a newspaper turf writer, but was constantly also working as a turf publicist,
yeah.
At Agua Caliente and then up to Bay Meadows,
yeah,
at Tanforan,
yeah.
And they had, and it was kind of interchangeable too. When they were running at Del Mar, he'd write for the San Diego Tribune. But then when racing went back up to San Francisco, he was a publicist for Tanforan or whatever track.
Wearing another hat.
And you guys did that a lot at that era. It wasn't like – and, of course, here we're now in an era where we've got year-round racing at a lot of the associations. So it's a little different. But you know what? A guy like Ben Huffman.
Yeah, right, at Churchill Downs.
And Keeneland.
Keeneland, yeah.
You know, so Ben has, you know, sort of that – ebb and flow.
Right, where you can set up housekeeping in one area.
Pat Pope as well.
Who
goes from Delaware to Oaklawn.
Right.
Tyler Picklesheimer has done this. There's, I guess, on some of the smaller, I don't want to call them the B circuits, but there are some of those.
Right.
You know, certainly,
yeah,
certainly
and
Keeneland
Doc
and
Levin
Churchill
was one of them.
The same kind of
like
thing.
Like I say, Oaklawn Park and Keeneland and Churchill Downs. And a couple more, you know.
Did you ever work for Charlie Sella?
Who? Charlie Sullivan?
Sella out at Oaklawn.
No.
The
no,
Sella
but
family.
I knew him well.
And his dad.
And
his family.
I was working Delaware's steward with Doc Lavin, and something came up in courts in Oaklawn, something with racing. And Doc told me, he said, Charlie Sella called, and he said he wants you to come too, you know. And the two of us flew there, and whatever it was taken care of, and then back to Delaware.
Interesting.
Yeah, and a nice man, too, Charlie Sella.
Well, and this, what's gone on there, and in fact, that's actually a fun that's a fun subplot, because Saratoga, Hot Springs. You mentioned Oriental Park and
Cuba.
Cuba. You think about Agua Caliente. I mean, you were around for that gambling era, and I suppose I can even fold in what was going on in northern Kentucky. Well, Louisville was a pretty sporting town,
right.
And Newport,
right,
up by Cincinnati,
right. You're right.
Kind of a rough and tumble sport
right.
in life.
How about that one Kentucky Downs?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, there's
the beautiful.
They give purses away that
now, yeah.
Yeah, they only run 2 weeks, I believe.
Yeah, not even but, it's about yeah. five sessions.
Right.
But you saw that gambling era,
right?
That,
right.
The 40s and 50s in particular.
Yes. Yeah, and it was going very strong at the time, and like Centennial in Colorado was a beautiful track. It was the same type of track as Hollywood Park in style and all. Mm. And the only thing I think that went wrong there, it wasn't as popular as they thought it would. They thought they could open up with
country.
The Hollywood Park type of racing and all, well, it couldn't be done, and eventually it closed up. One race would be a quarter horse race, and some good owners and trainers, but like I say, management I think got carried away with like we got the track and that wasn't supported that much. And
it made me think too. You had to have over the years because of the breadth of your career. And particularly when somebody like Marge Everett, you had to have come across countless sports and entertainment
right.
celebrities that were track regulars. And I mean, and you know, your name is synonymous really with the name Tommy Trotter. It kind of was very typical in when you see photographs and there's a lot of the books tracking racing history. It feels like you were always there with the celebrities and sports stars.
Right. Met many of them too, you know, really.
Sure.
That one year, some of the photographs, they had a party at one of the hotels in New York City, and that was Santa Anita and NYRA, New York Racing, putting the party on. And it was really, with owners and trainers sure. and jockeys and all. Tremendous. Yeah, it was really a great thing to do. And that's where Jimmy Kilroy, I think, got leaned over towards Santa Anita then, you know, and I think he put that party together.
And at that point, was because they started in 1930 and 30, they just had their anniversary, right? They just had the 75th anniversary. So when did Jimmy Kilroy? I mean, I always think of him as starting out in California.
He started going there in the wintertime.
Okay.
Because there was no racing.
Right,
in,
that's true. In New York, that's right.
He also did Arlington Park at one time for Marge, Jimmy. And then when he finally decided, for whatever reason, to leave New York, he loved California climate or whatever, and that's when he left, and a great, great official too.
Well, and a name that lives on the Kilroy Mile, and
right.
In fact, when you watch these races, you mentioned John Campbell, I think earlier. There's so many names that people know as titles of races,
right.
but don't necessarily, unless they make the effort to educate themselves, know what the place is in racing history.
And I started my first year in 1945 at Fairgrounds in New Orleans, and the racing secretary was the assistant to John Campbell in New York, a person by the name of Julius Reeder, and he was the racing secretary at Fairgrounds then. And when I completed that meeting, I went to Florida and worked, I think, Tropical Park, and then Mr. Campbell had me to come on to New York to work as the first sort of as a private secretary for him, and then taking entries and all, and that's how it all started.
Tommy Trotter is with us, and most often I've reached out to Tommy to talk about individuals and certain things about the game, but have never really have had this this wide spread discussion of his career. And before we wrap up, Tommy, I got to ask. you know, you're thought of as one of the great gentlemen around the sport. But you must have had there must have been a trainer or a management that you had to bump heads with that you know, sort of like when they talk about pitchers in baseball that couldn't get one guy out. There was always one guy that used to get hits or. Who gave you the most trouble, whether it was playful trouble or loggerheads?
Well, I don't recall any. You know,
that doesn't surprise me. I'm going to use an example. Yesterday, you presented the trophy to Davey Jacobson.
That's him, right.
Who was so excited to have the occasion to say hello, and because his father, who was you know, certainly known as not the easiest guy to get along with. And Davey acknowledged that,
right,
and said that his father thought the world of you. So you won over Buddy Jacobson. So you obviously couldn't have had too many people that you tangled with.
No, you know, they've all got their problems, and maybe I understood it through my own father, you know.
Sure.
Raising a family and training horses and all that. So, in fact, I found so many really good ones. I could go through a list of those, but going back to Buddy, he was so cooperative in running horses that he was a good person to have on the grounds, and he helped a lot there in
Phil Races.
New York Racing. Yeah.
Do you and there's a great topic to round out the discussion with too. The game today and the way races and cards are drawn. Any thoughts about what you see today? Positive, negatives. Your overall impression of the game from that standpoint, and from your long period of experience.
I think it's, if anything, it's getting better, and more like we talked about the entries and all. Coupling horses, stables. So I think those are things that are helpful to racing. And every year they come up with something new that's beneficial to thoroughbred racing.
Your favorite track that you worked in, or the favorite that you visit?
Mine was at Gulfstream Park when Doug Don,
the old Gulfstream,
was my He was a wonderful person to work for, and we always had a. He just come down to the office every day and check out how the races were going, and it was when he left the Gulfstream, and they honored me at a charitable organization, Children Resources, in Florida with small children, and I was the honored guest, and Doug called him up and said, I'd like to be the one to present the award to Tommy. So he got up on the floor there this audience, and he just went on about good things of racing and how Tommy Trotter did this. He was so great, you know, when he finished, and I went up to get the award. I said, Doug, if you got any money left, buy another track. I'll go back to work.
I love it. I've got to acknowledge Ellie here too. How did you guys meet up on the track or?
I went to his retirement dinner. A friend of mine had introduced us.
That's too funny. How long are you guys together?
10 years, 11 years.
Right.
We'll be married.
And we flew out to Del Mar, and I'd never been there.
You'd never gone to Del
No,
Mar?
No, I had been to Santa Anita and Hollywood, but not Del Mar. And it was beautiful. Tom Robbins was a friend.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a good one. And
another racetrack fan. Like
yeah, that. Right. And so that's how we...
We pulled in, and I must tell you, I've been going there for years.
To Del Mar.
Of the department and everything. So we go in, and I have to park the car, and I pull right in, and I give the guy what I always gave. He says, you can't park here. It's the racing officials that park here, right?
Right.
California. I said, believe me, I can park here, and we park.
Well,
and she, we went from there to Arlington Park to
Delaware.
Yeah, and won at every track.
Well, a winner in racing's long history, Tommy Trotter, and Ellie here, and back at Saratoga again for another round of the round table. And Tommy, it's been just an absolute delight having you here, and this is a conversation I've wanted to have for years now, and I'm so appreciative, and I know everybody listening is as well.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate all you've done for me too.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. It's your generosity with me and with the listeners and with the industry.
Right.
For three quarters of a century, Tommy Trotter. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much.